On Wednesday morning, Donald Trump once again told his mob that the media have become the enemy of the people. NBC reporter Shamari Stone posted video showing rioters and white nationalists destroying and stomping on TV equipment and chasing out reporters. In one case, punching an Associated Press photographer. They repeated Trump by yelling, "The media is the enemy of the people." He wrote, "I've never seen anything like this in my 20-year career." Media critics say many in the national press have largely failed to cover Trump and his white supremacist supporters over the past 4 years. Later in the show, we will talk about the Democratic victories in Georgia. Join us after the news. Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We begin today's show by talking about how the media have covered Donald Trump and his white nationalist supporters over the past 4 years. Some media critics have tough words for the national press. Eric Bollert, who founded Press Run, writes, quote, "It's hard to think about what might have been if the press had carried out its duties differently over the last 4 years, if the press had shown more courage and not allowed itself to be bullied by a madman." In a New York Times op-ed, Seward Darby, editor-in-chief of the Atavist magazine and author of Sisters in Hate, American Women on the Front Lines of White Nationalism, writes, quote, "Establishment institutions have long treated the threat of right-wing violence as a fringe matter. The government has done it, all but defining terrorism as a crime that could be perpetrated only by people who were not white. Law enforcement has done it. The press has been complicit too, perpetuating narratives about lone wolves and isolated incidents rather than doing the urgent work of connecting the dots." Well, joining us to give us their take on media coverage are two guests. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and author of several best-selling books, including his most recent, "It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America." David K. Johnston has been covering Donald Trump for decades and has been warning about some version of what we saw on Wednesday for years. David is the founder and editor-in-chief of the nonprofit news service DC Report. Hi, David. Welcome back to the show.
Well, Rose, thank you for having me on again.
Well, it's great to have you back. Joshua Holland is a contributor to The Nation magazine and co-host of the podcast We've Got Issues. Hi, Joshua. Thank you for joining us again.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for having me.
Well, great to have both of you. Before we dive in, I just want to ask you both, what was really going through your mind as you were watching all of this unfold on TV? David, you've been covering Trump for decades. What was going through your mind?
Well, beginning with the rally in the morning and seeing the incitement to violence by Donald Trump, Don Jr., Rudy Giuliani, and Congressman Mo Brooks of Alabama, who showed up in camo. At that point, I was pretty sure the minute the crowd began to go to the Capitol, and Trump, of course, being the cowardly bully he is, doesn't lead his army of insurgents, but goes to the safety of the White House, that there would be serious violence. And I expected that the Capitol Police had already bivouacked inside the building. I mean, I remember, for example, covering the riot in downtown Palo Alto 50 years ago, where when the rioters got out of hand downtown, hundreds of police in riot gear appeared out of the buildings. They had been housed in homes and garages and whatnot, waiting to appear. And clearly the Capitol Police, which is a big, well-funded police force with a budget of over $500 million a year, was not prepared for this. And we saw the murder of a police officer, for which all of the people I named who spoke at the rally, as I read the federal statute, can be prosecuted for his murder under the felony murder rule. If you want to look it up, it's 18 U.S. Code 1111.
Who would have to be who would decide if these people are prosecuted?
Well, The federal government has jurisdiction because it occurred on the in the Capitol. And District of Columbia, which I believe also has a felony murder rule. I've been looking for it and haven't found the right statute, but I believe it also has a felony murder rule, would both have jurisdiction here. The felony murder rule essentially is that if you set in motion a felonious crime, and I don't think anybody can dispute that what this mob did was a felony, hundreds of felonies, that you are responsible for what happens. And now we've seen people go to prison for things like, my friend said they wanted to, me to give them a ride, and then we pulled up to a place to get beer, and they went in and shot the owner to death. I didn't know they were going to do that. Well, you get life in prison. I think that's overly harsh, and that's why we have mercy in the law. But in this case, nobody listening to or watching those speeches can think that this was anything but an incitement to insurrection and to overthrow the government of the United States. But even if you can't accept that, this was clearly an incitement to violence. It led to two deaths that we can directly attribute to it. The police officer whose head was smashed in with a fire extinguisher, and the woman who was shot trying to break in, a former military member. These are serious crimes, and they were done at the instigation of the president of the United States, an absolute violation of his oath of office. The same for Mo Brooks. And I think that the comments of especially Mo Brooks warrant his expulsion from Congress, his immediate expulsion from Congress.
David, because there's so many moving parts to this, can you tell us more about, is it Mo or Mel Brooks?
Well, he goes by, I think it's Mo Brooks.
It's Mo, yeah, Mo Brooks.
Mo Brooks.
Yeah, it's Mo Brooks. Okay. Mel Brooks is the great comedian. Donald Trump, I warned 5 years ago, even before he got in the Republican nomination, that if Trump became president, it would end badly and it would end in violence. And that's what we are seeing. Now, he's today backed away, and yet he continues to say the fight has just begun. That's a signal to these crazy people who have no concept of what American democracy is about. You know, there are plans. You can go around the internet and find the plans to have a huge demonstration on January 20th. And these people clearly want to have a violent confrontation on Inauguration Day. One of the reasons beyond his own weak ego that Donald Trump will not attend the inauguration. We need to be paying attention to these folks. And I've been trying to get editors to listen to me about this since way back in the 60s when I was writing about radicals on the left and the right on the San Francisco Peninsula for the San Jose Mercury, people who built bombs, people who orchestrated crimes and clearly saw themselves as heroic patriotic revolutionaries on both the right and the left, but are in fact incompetent criminals who wreak havoc and justly deserve to feel the weight of law enforcement.
And I just found a piece about Mo Brooks at The Intercept. He's a representative from Alabama. Lee Fong writes, he's one of the most outspoken lawmakers in support of Trump's lies about the election being stolen. And he was one of the opening speakers at that rally before rioters broke into the Capitol, just for some context. And then also for people who might not know the details about what happened to this Capitol police officer, his name is Brian Sicknick, according to CNN. He was injured Wednesday night. The Chicago Tribune reports, based on Capitol Police reports, that he was hit in the head with a fire extinguisher. Just to give you the information, because there are so many moving parts to all of this. Joshua Holland, first off, what was going through your mind? I mean, you've been a long-time political reporter. What was going through your mind as you were watching all of this unfold?
You know, Rose, I'm going to just say something personal, which is that it's been so stressful these months and months and months leading up to the campaign. And it was striking to me what a roller coaster it was to go from winning those two Senate seats in Georgia, which I did not expect. And that, you know, coming out of that real game changer to this outburst of violence and incoherence in on the Capitol. I would echo what David said, though. I did expect, I absolutely expected that there would be a massive security presence at the Capitol. I've covered a number of demonstrations in D.C. It is a very heavily policed area, and they are accustomed to dealing with large crowds. And according to reports that are coming in today and yesterday, it seems like there was not a threat assessment conducted by the FBI. I believe it was the chief of the Capitol Police who said that there was not intelligence suggesting that violence was possible, which was startling to me because many of us have been watching the very public organizing of this siege on sites like Parlay, the conservative alternative to Twitter, and Gab for weeks and weeks and weeks. And they've been extremely explicit. There have been flyers posted online saying we are going to storm the Capitol. So with all of that as a lead up, when I was watching Trump's speech and he was inciting the crowd to go to the Capitol, I felt very confident that they were going to be greeted by a significant, you know, line of riot police, as I've seen so many times in D.C. And it was remarkable to see these people overrunning an overwhelmed security force. And in some cases, it seemed like there was a tendency to just let them in and let them do what they wanted. And it was a stunning disconnect from the violent responses we saw to Black Lives Matter protesters earlier in the year.
Right. David, over the past few days, we've been talking about this. There's been video of a police officer taking a selfie with these rioters. According to a frontline ProPublica investigation, these groups planned the riot weeks ago. They openly discussed the idea of a violent protest on the day Congress met to certify the election results. They named their riot Wild Protest, which is a name taken from a tweet by Trump encouraging his supporters to take to the streets. He tweeted, "We'll be wild." What really stands out for you, David, now that the media are trying to get these questions answered about why this happened?
Well, we need to recognize that these groups that are fomenting this and who are proposing that we have more violence on Inauguration Day are a clear and present danger and a serious criminal threat. I mean, even the FBI, over the objections of Donald Trump and the Homeland Security Department over his objections, have been pointing out that this is the most serious organized problem we find as a threat to our republic. These groups, particularly on the far right, that are armed and that are full of people who are looking to create trouble. And a couple of things in the riot to pay attention to. First of all, Donald Trump's wall doesn't work, as proven by his supporters. You can see the photos of them climbing up ropes to overcome a high wall. Secondly, there were people in these demonstrations wearing shirts with slogans such as 6 million is not nearly enough and Camp Auschwitz. Many of these people are vicious, murderous individuals. Third, there are photos of police officers, and it's not conclusive, but they're certainly suggestive that some of the Capitol Police were helpful to the rioters. You can see them seeming to encourage them to move forward, to smile at them. In contrast with others, there was a lone officer we have very good video footage of, met by a mob who had to retreat up the stairs, and I thought he handled his situation where he clearly could have been killed very well. So we need to recognize this is the most serious attack on the government of the United States, without which we do not have our liberties, our prosperity, our peace, since the attack on Fort Sumter in 1861. These are actions that are criminal, they are traitorous, they are seditious, and they were orchestrated at the direction of the President of the United States. And to not remove him from office. The House today, and I encourage people here to call Nancy Pelosi's office today. Why have you not moved today to have a vote on on impeaching the president. The Senate may not act because Mitch McConnell is still majority leader, but nonetheless, the House should act to hold him responsible. And why has Mo Brooks not been expelled from the House? The House determines who is appropriately a member, and no one is more fittingly removed from office by the House than Mo Brooks. He has no business holding a public office. He belongs in prison.
Well, yesterday, a number of callers let us know that Nancy Pelosi's voicemail is full, and so there's no way to get in touch with her office other than email. Just a couple pieces of information coming down in the last couple of hours. Politico writes that Pelosi has asked the Joint Chiefs about preventing Trump from launching nukes. She says Trump is unhinged and the nation must be protected from him, she wrote in a letter to colleagues. There's also reports that she has pledged to proceed with impeachment proceedings. She says today that if Trump does not imminently and willingly leave office, the Democratic-led House will move forward with the second impeachment of Donald Trump. Joshua, what are your thoughts on just what's coming down in the last couple of hours?
I feel like Nancy Pelosi does not want to impeach if she can pressure Mike Pence and the cabinet to invoke the 25th Amendment. And I think that, you know, talking about putting in safeguards against the commander in chief, ordering up a military attack is part of that pressure campaign. I don't think there's a legal standing for that. Although it should be noted that in the last days of the Nixon administration, when Nixon was drinking heavily and seemed to be, you know, raving about perceived enemies everywhere, his Secretary of Defense did have a little conversation with Joint Chiefs of Staff and said that he would need to sign off on any military deployment. So maybe there's something unofficial that is possible, but I don't know how long it takes. I don't know what the minimum amount of time is to do the consultations that you need to do within your own caucus and draw up articles of impeachment and schedule a vote. I honestly do not know what is the quickest they can do that. Remember that they were certifying the Electoral College votes until, I believe, 4 a.m. Right. So if they come and if they bring it to a vote on if they were to impeach, bring articles of impeachment to the floor on Tuesday, that would be very, very fast. I just want to make one other point about the idea that there was police complicity. House Majority Whip Clyburn said on a radio show today that protesters went to his office, an office that he had that had no name on it, that was not publicly known. And they went right in there. They knew who they were going to. They started harassing his staff. And he said to this, again, this was a radio show on Sirius XM, said, how did they know to go there? How come they didn't go where my name was? They went where you won't find my name, but they found where I was supposed to be. So something else was going on untoward here. And, you know, I think that we need to see this as two distinct groups. There was a Trump rally, right? There were hundreds of thousands of people, or not hundreds of thousands, sorry, tens of thousands of people who were just Trump supporters, who thought that this was going to be like another Trump protest, like a boat parade, whatever. This group was the people who we have to worry about are the Proud Boys, the Three Percenters, the Oath Keepers. There is an organized component within this group that was out ahead of the crowd, right? So Trump had his little speech and he said, okay, we're going to go down to the Capitol. I'm going to walk with you, he said, which was, of course, not true. And but there had already been a vanguard of people who had left while Trump was speaking and had gotten to the Capitol and had begun the process of taking down gates and stuff like that. This is all according to reports. I'm not in DC, I should point out. And, you know, it's these people who have been organizing for weeks to overrun the Congress and take members of the legislature hostage. They've been saying this. Several of them were photographed with zip ties, flexi cuffs, I should say. And, these are the people who are organizing another protest again, online, publicly. You can all see it on sites like Parlay and Gab for either the 19th or the 20th, either the day before or the day of the inauguration. There's different different strains of organizing going on. But one other point that I would make is that all of the attention on the 20th is going to be in D.C., and we should be very conscious of the fact that they may be planning to do things at other state capitals while everybody is kind of focused on D.C. And you know, D.C. has lots of law enforcement cooperation, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. Well, you brought up a number of points there, and I'm so glad you brought up the fact that people are taking to the streets in capitals across the country that hasn't gotten as much attention because of what happened in D.C. And David, I know that you tweeted about this horrific, horrific story. I'm trying to find the name of this woman. I'm just going to scroll here for a minute. In Los Angeles, a black woman was walking down the street with her friends. And okay, here, I just found it. Her name is Barlinda Nebo. And she said she was walking down the street. There was a Trump mob was protesting. She said, quote, "It's just me. And all of a sudden I'm getting cornered by 30, 40 people. That's what started all of them to jump in and shove me. Then some lady comes out of nowhere, starts tugging on my hair, trying to pull my hair off my head." Horrific photos of this large white man literally holding this woman. I mean, he's got his huge arms around her, and she was the only black person in this crowd of Trump supporters.
Yes, and we're going to see more of that kind of targeted harassment by these white supremacists, because remember that Donald Trump is not the disease. He is the symptom of the disease, of the breakdown in America of a cohesive culture that celebrates the freedoms and opportunities created by our Constitution. You know, the truth is the Civil War isn't over and never has been. By the way, one thing Josh said I want to make sure we don't miss. I'm not concerned that Donald Trump will launch a nuclear missile for a simple reason. Well, sailors and grunts take an oath to follow the orders of the president and defend the Constitution. Military officers only take an oath to uphold the Constitution. And the Pentagon has signaled to key officers not to follow any illegal orders. Now, they all know that. It's part of their training. But I do not believe our military officers will follow any kind of illegal or dubious order in these closing days of the Trump administration.
David, you have covered Trump for decades. What do you think he is capable of in the next 12 days?
Well, he's been engaged in political vandalism since the night of the election, and you'll see more. He's going to issue more pardons. I think he's foreclosed the option of resigning and having Mike Pence pardon him, so I anticipate he'll probably pardon himself and that eventually the Supreme Court will hold that that's not a valid pardon, because if we allow a president to pardon himself, that would mean Donald Trump could go on to federal property where there's no state jurisdiction and murder people and then pardon himself. It would make him above the law. And the Supreme Court made clear last summer the president is not above the law, much as Donald Trump likes to think that he is. Once he's out of office and up until he is arrested, and I do anticipate he's going to be indicted in a number of jurisdictions, that Donald Trump will could try to operate as a government in exile, fomenting violence and insurrection against the United States, because in Donald's mind, he really believes that he is the superior person, that of course he should run the United States, and you are all idiots if you don't understand that. And he has convinced himself of this over years because of the horrible circumstances of how he grew up. He himself has said he's never done anything wrong in his life. He was asked once, because he claims he's a Christian, even though he says his philosophy is revenge, which is anti-Christian. And he has written pages and pages in one of his books denouncing Christians as idiots and fools and schmucks. He was once asked, you know, well, when did you last ask God for forgiveness? And, you know, he looked at the person like this was a crazy question and said, Well, never. Why would I do that? I've never done anything that requires forgiveness. The man is mad. He's crazy. He's delusional. And he has conned 70 plus million Americans, 10 million more than he did 4 years ago, into voting for him. And I lay the blame for a lot of that on my business, on my former editors at the New York Times and the LA Times, who wouldn't listen to me and who did not vet him in 2015 and 16 when it was their duty to do it. Instead, we focused on the phony email scandal, the completely phony lie about the IRS and right-wing groups. For those who don't know, the IRS was totally even-handed. They were just as hard on left-wing groups as right-wing groups. In fact, the only groups who lost their tax-exempt status were progressive organizations. The Donald Trump is not going away unless and until he's imprisoned. And as I say in an article I have today in the Daily Mail in London, he will then, to his followers, become a martyr. That's why it's absolutely crucial that we need to have criminal prosecutions and convictions over what happened in this effort to overthrow our government. And don't underestimate what happened here. The House was voting to certify and confirm that Joe Biden would be the next president. This crowd went there to stop that, and they delayed it. This is a coup attempt. It failed. Well, the history of the world is full of coup attempts that failed, followed by successful coups.
David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, author of It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. Joshua Holland is a contributor to The Nation magazine and co-host of We've Got Issues. It's a podcast. And if you'd like to join us, David and Joshua will be with us for about 10 more minutes, and then we will talk about the monumental wins in Georgia. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at KALW.org. Let's hear from a few callers who've been waiting patiently. Raul in San Francisco. Hi, Raul.
Yes, hello. I hope you can hear me.
Yes, you're fine.
And I want to make clear that I have made this statement before, that the reason that Donald Trump is able to enter the mainstream of this country and their life is through the broadcast of people like Rush Limbaugh, Michael Savage, who called for armed insurrection on his last show, Mark Levin, who's called for armed insurrection. And the media has been terrified because, as I can see, because of any repercussions that might come to them on their ability to report, and also from their followers, who will do anything that they say. And they have patently circumvented or avoided any type of confrontation or calling those out for what they are doing. And just as a case in point, while I was listening to your show now, Rush Limbaugh is on his show, because I listened to both sides, claiming that Donald Trump is innocent, and in fact it is Kamala Harris who's causing this creation of these problems, who has now been named Communist Harris, or Commie, as she likes to call her, one of his little jokes, and that Donald Trump is being vilified and that he needs to be supported and people need to stand up even stronger. That's what he's saying right now to over 15 point something million followers that they know of who will do anything that this demagogue asks for. When does the media take on those people? That's what I want to know.
It's such a great point, Raul. Thank you so much for bringing that to today's show. Joshua, what are your thoughts? In addition to what Raul is talking about with people like Rush Limbaugh, I mean, you've got, YouTube videos and then platforms we've probably never heard of that go deep into these dark conspiracy theories.
A couple of points here. First of all, this is really the crux of the matter. And I think that we need to be very, very careful about holding people responsible for propagating the conspiracy theories about this election, which was clearly free and fair, conducted well, won by Joe Biden by a significant margin, with the entitlement of the insurrectionists, right? I mean, they stormed that Capitol and they thought that they had every right to do so because something was being stolen from them. The other point that I would make is that, you know, one of the things that democracy requires is that the stakes are low enough that the losing party can accept defeat. And that is something that we are not, this is really the heart of our dysfunction right now, is that both parties are afraid of being governed by the other party. And, you know, if you look at the things that people are fearful of, if you ask people on the left, they will tell you things like losing health care, which Republicans have tried relentlessly to strip from them, you know, killing protections for LGBT rights, not addressing climate change, et cetera, not respecting democracy. And all of those things are real concerns. And if you look at the narratives that the conservative media, and this goes from the mainstream conservative media, not just the fever swamps, you know, Democrats are going to come in and they're going to burn down the cities and they're going to get rid of, you know, suburbs, and they want to get rid of cows and just crazy stuff. And the stakes on that side, you know, nobody who is out there attending these protests or storming the Capitol or spreading conspiracy theories about a cabal of cannibal Democrats, none of them are worried about Democrats raising taxes somewhat on high-end earners to expand public health care. They're not worried about the budget deficit. They're not worried about the Democrats' real agenda. And this split in reality is something that I don't know how to address that. We have a First Amendment in this country. The conservative media has a right to spread dangerous lies about the opposition, to demagogue. And, you know, but those things have consequences. And what we really need is for some of those people to take responsibility. And I don't know how we get there.
David, what are your thoughts?
Well, let's understand the reason there are so many people willing to overthrow the government of the United States. And it's largely economics. The bottom 90% of Americans made less money in 2018 than in 1973 when you adjust for inflation. They only got 50 weeks of income, not 52 weeks in 2018. Under Donald Trump, the incomes of the vast majority declined, despite his constant lying about this and its largely uncritical acceptance in news reports, because most journalists are innumerate and don't know how to go check the numbers. There was enormous economic growth at the top, 27% increase for people who make $1 million or more in this country, and people who make $100 million, $50 million or more a year salary, I think, doubled under Trump. People who played by the rules and have seen their economics go to hell are legitimately aggrieved. And I fault the Democrats for not paying attention to these people's concerns. For, you know, there's a legitimate criticism. The Democrats have focused more on college-educated people than they have on blue-collar workers with a high school education or less. And we're now seeing the fruits of that. We need to have a real serious discussion about the economy in America. I used to cynically joke that the most generous people in the history of the world were American manufacturing workers who gave up their rise into the middle class so that the rural poor of China and Vietnam and the Philippines could have an opportunity to live a better life. And of course, they were forced into that. We have real serious economic problems, and they are driving this anger and hatred. And then, of course, you lay over that America's long history of racism, of the acceptance of much of the legacy of the antebellum South. I mentioned the offensive T-shirts these people wore. You brought up, Rose, the woman who was surrounded in Los Angeles that I had tweeted about. We have these military bases named for traitors. Let's be clear. The Old South military leaders were traitors. Or as my father, who grew up in New Orleans, used to say to me, Yankees were too damn magnanimous. They should have hung every one of them. I don't agree with that, but I don't think we should be naming military bases and roads on them. We did a several investigative pieces of DC Report about one of the highest ranking black civilians in the Army who was driven out of his job by people with clear histories of racist backgrounds over these very issues. And the Democrats said, we're going to hold a hearing into the racist purge going on in the civilian ranks of the Army. We can't even get them to come to the phone. So we really need to address our real problems and not these nonsense problems that we see ginned up by people like Rush Limbaugh and the others who are, let's be clear, not patriotic Americans. They are enemies of our Constitution. They are enemies of our liberties. And they're doing everything they can to destroy this country. One last thing, go on the internet and take a look at the Russian state media yesterday and the smiling pictures of Vladimir Putin paired with the assault on the U.S. Capitol by Donald Trump's thugs. Mm.
David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, author of It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. David is founder and editor-in-chief of the nonprofit news service DC Report. David, thank you as always for your work, and thanks for joining us.
Take care.
Joshua Holland is a contributor to The Nation magazine and is co-host of a podcast with a really great name, We've Got Issues. Joshua, thank you for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rose.
Thanks so much. Before we end this segment, I want to thank Brad for sending in an article about Berlinda Nebo. The article that I read yesterday, The Root, made it sound like the man who was bear-hugging Berlinda was attacking her. But Berlinda told KTTV that the entire time this man kept whispering in her ear, "Don't move. They're trying to kill you. They're trying to kill you." And then let her go. So she said, if he didn't step in at that moment, these people would have literally tried to kill me. Thank you so much for sending this in, Brad, because that important piece of information was not in the Root article. So thank you for that. And we will link to this on our website, yourcallradio.org. Coming up after a short break, we will talk about the monumental victories in Georgia. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to talk about the monumental victories in Georgia. The violent mob attack on Capitol Hill has really overshadowed the results of the historic runoff elections in Georgia. Raphael Warnock got a lot of attention because it happened the day before, but John Ossoff's victory came the same day that all eyes were on Washington, D.C. So joining us to talk about this and media coverage is Stephen Fowler, an award-winning reporter and photographer for Georgia Public Broadcasting. Hi, Stephen. Welcome back to the show.
Always a pleasure.
Great to have you. So what is the mood in Georgia after this double historic win?
It's a really kind of a bittersweet mood because of the events that unfolded at the U.S. Capitol. But for Democrats, it's a feeling of vindication. For years, Democrats have been telling people they could flip the state, that it was winnable for Democrats if they had the right candidates and the right resources and the right sort of support. And especially after they came so close in 2018 with Stacey Abrams, 55,000 votes short, Joe Biden won by 12,000 votes. It looks like John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock will win by, you know, about 50 to 100,000 votes. And so there is just a real satisfaction in seeing that result finally happen and come at a pivotal time in our nation.
For the past few months, we have spoken to a wide range of on-the-ground organizers, Latino organizations. There have been Native groups that have done incredible door-knocking. Of course, a number of Black groups doing organizing in Black communities. What does the coverage of that look like in Georgia, Stephen? Because it's getting so much national attention.
Right. Well, you're starting to see a lot of the campaign postmortems come out, and they're really focusing on the amount of Black turnout in particular. Black voters make up about 30% of Georgia's electorate, and they're a very, very reliable Democratic voting bloc. But in some of these races, and in runoffs in particular, they don't show out as much. And so the Ossoff and Warnock campaigns made intentional investments in Southwest Georgia, in the rural Black community, where there are a lot of voters and a lot of people that don't normally show up. And also, it's an area where a lot of campaigns and politicians don't show up. And so as soon as they found out they were going to a runoff, they really doubled down on those investments and held rallies and did door knocking and recruitment and worked with young people in those communities to get out the vote. And you can see it really paid dividends. I mean, Randolph County is one county in Southwest Georgia that had almost the same amount of turnout in this January election as it did in the November election. And that wasn't by accident. That was because of the investment and because of the targeted focus that the Democratic campaigns put in this often overlooked region.
You know, when we talked to organizers, we noted that so much of the media coverage was about Washington, D.C. and flipping the Senate, which obviously is so incredibly monumental. But the issues that are happening in Georgia didn't get as much attention. And we heard that so many people in Georgia are still waiting for their unemployment checks. People desperately need Medicaid expansion and health care. COVID has hit Georgia so hard. What are your thoughts about what really stood out in the platforms of Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff? What is their key agenda when they get to Washington and how it will really affect the people of Georgia?
Well, their slogan for a lot of their final appearances together was jobs, justice, and health care. And you know, the coronavirus pandemic has hit Georgia especially hard, and especially non-white Georgians very hard. And part of the literal closing message where President-elect Joe Biden came to town to campaign was, you know, if you send these two for the Senate, we can get you $2,000 checks. We can get relief to help you get through this and to help jumpstart the economy. We can tackle vaccine distribution and rollout so people aren't waiting months and months longer than they need to get vaccinated and to restart things. And we are going to do things to kind of bend the moral arc of the universe a little bit stronger towards equity and justice when it comes to criminal justice and other big issues that actually matter more than a political party. And I think that's something that resonated with a lot of people that you maybe found a little bit less of on the other side of the aisle.
The other thing that people are talking about is Democrats in historically conservative states tend to, you know, be very moderate in their with their language. They don't go all out and just speak the truth about what people are dealing with. And people say that Josh Ossoff and Warnock really did go all out and talk about health care and wages. They're both pro-choice. They want to take they want to really do something about the climate crisis. So can you talk about that? Because when you look at, say, what happened in Kentucky with Amy McGrath and the campaign she ran, obviously very different states, different people. But talk a little bit about how they really went all out and were not afraid to really talk about the issues.
Well, Ossoff and Warnock running together as a ticket really were able to reach a lot more people in a lot more ways than some of these other states and races. And, you know, I would really argue that Ossoff and Warnock were really not that progressive because of Georgia's electorate and because it's so close. But the language and the messaging that they used did not come across as an Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez style message that could have turned off moderate voters. And they really focused on what was happening in Georgia and how it could affect Georgians, and really not co-opted language, but really structured their campaigns and arguments in a way that didn't seem like they were on the left edge of the party and appealed to a lot more people and, frankly, used a lot of plain language. Some of that comes from Ossoff being a documentary filmmaker and from Warnock being a Black Baptist preacher, but they really met people where they are in giving this sort of progressive Democratic message in a way that was easier to swallow and understand for a lot of people.
That's very interesting. I wish that the media would do a better job of just using plain language to talk about where people are instead of framing it through a left versus right lens, because that is so simplistic, especially when we're talking about people who are really struggling to make ends meet and are afraid to go to the doctor because of the high costs.
Yeah, and I think some of that is apparent, too, in the third race that was on Georgia's ballot for our statewide public service commission. It's a utility regulator. The Republican incumbent in that race actually got more votes than David Perdue or Kelly Loeffler, in spite of that race seeing a much bigger drop off and fewer people voting. And some of that is because of the homegrown kind of campaign style that he had. He didn't tie himself to Trump or talk about Trumpian policies. He went around and talked to people about what it means to lower the cost of electricity and to build nuclear power and diversify our energy sources and do things in a way that it wasn't really a left or right. And you saw people that maybe voted for John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock also vote for Bubba McDonald, a Republican. And so I think you can kind of see the inverse of that there in that race.
I want to talk also about what this means for the Black community, because this was a monumental win. Again, we are talking about a southern state, Georgia, and I want to play a clip from Latasha Brown, who founded Black Votes Matter in 2016. Latasha and her team have been doing incredible on-the-ground work in Georgia, and this is from an interview she did with NPR's Mary Louise Kelly. Mary Louise asked Latasha what this means for her and the Black community.
So I think I am extremely excited about him winning because of what he represents. He represents Black Southerners that against the odds, that in a space that has been the home for the Confederacy, the space that has been the root, right, for white supremacy and white nationalists, that where the Southern strategy was born, that there is a new Southern strategy that is being implemented, that is being fueled and engined by people of color, and Black folks are on the vanguard.
And I hope you can take the time to listen to the entire interview, because it is really powerful what Latasha says. What are you hearing from other older people in Georgia, Stephen, who really have seen so much like Latasha?
Well, you know, that's part of the appeal that Raphael Warnock brought to this, in essence, a Democratic ticket, because he is steeped in the history of civil rights and activism and political involvement. And because, you know, he may not be a politician, but he has decades of sermons from the pulpit speaking about social issues and economic issues and things that politicians also deal with, that he has this rich history to draw from. And really, his election kind of ties the thread back to the civil rights movement in Atlanta and in Georgia and in the South, and kind of offers a continuation of leaders like John Lewis and C.T. Vivian and others that helped pave the way so that we could have our first Black senator in 2021. And, you know, it reminds voters, because so long the conventional wisdom was, if you want to win as a Democrat in the South, you've got to be a white moderate. So you can appeal to white voters and to try to appeal to Black voters as well. But this shows, and what Stacey Abrams shows, and what this race shows, is that you can win by being reflective of your electorate and by showing Black voters in Georgia that, you know, their words and their actions and their feelings matter as a not insignificant portion of Georgia's population.
It was very interesting to learn that Warnock actually has a history as a sexual health educator. Before becoming the senior pastor at Ebenezer Baptist Church, he engaged the faith community around HIV/AIDS.
Yeah, it's almost reductive to just think of him just as a pastor, because especially in the Black church, it's not just somebody who gets up on a Sunday morning and preaches a sermon and then everyone goes home, that there really is this in-depth community involvement. And, you know, Raphael Warnock, I was reminded yesterday that, you know, Raphael Warnock was arrested in the U.S. Capitol a couple of years back protesting efforts to try to undo health care in the country, the same Capitol that, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of people were not arrested for overtaking the seat of our government. And it's a stunning picture there to see his involvement and, you know, a peaceful protest arrest contrasted with the violent mob attack at the Capitol. And, you know, it just goes to show that he may not have political experience per se, but his decades of life experience in the spheres of politics has definitely shaped his platform and message, and now will shape it in the U.S. Senate.
You know, Harper's Bazaar wrote a piece about this, and they interviewed a number of activists in Georgia who are working at the intersection of abortion rights and reproductive justice. This didn't get much attention in the media, but on abortion, of course, these candidates could not be further apart, the Republicans and the Democrats. And these activists say that they're just really looking forward to seeing what Warnock does in D.C. around these issues, because as we know, we've done so many shows about this, Stephen, so many women in the South, especially women of color and poor women and girls, do not have access to reproductive health care.
Right. And Georgia, actually, you know, part of the groundswell of activism that mobilized people to the polls and mobilized more diverse slates of candidates to run this year is from Georgia's abortion law that was struck down but passed last year that would have outlawed most abortions after 6 weeks after a fetal heartbeat activity was detected. And there were massive protests at the Capitol for multiple days, and there were lawsuits, and there were really a lot of women and Democrats that saw that and took action. And that's how we've seen this kind of groundswell of different groups being mobilized and different issue-based voters come out of the woodwork and participate because they see these candidates that reflect their values. And, you know, it's just part of a trend of Georgia's shifting demographics and shifting politics that I think will definitely be interesting to see, especially because Georgia still has a Republican governor and Republican state legislature.
Right, exactly. So what does that mean for Georgians? I mean, we spoke with Anoa Changa last week, and she said that they are preparing for more voter suppression laws. And, you know, again, it's really important to talk about the reality of what Georgians on the ground are facing.
Well, six of our eight Republican U.S. House members voted to against certifying some Electoral College votes. And we've seen our state legislature indicate that they want to try to crack down on voting laws, and because they said that there was fraud, even though there's no evidence of that. And we've saw one chamber say they're going to get rid of no excuse absentee voting. Our House said maybe not, but we need to add more restrictions to it. And maybe we need to take power from the Secretary of State. There have already been bills pre-filed to change the way overseas votes are counted and cast. And so couple that with redistricting, and this year legislative sessions in Georgia and across the country are going to shape the power for the decades to come.
Stephen Fowler is an award-winning reporter and photographer for Georgia Public Broadcasting. Stephen, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Joanne Marr and Kevin Vance for keeping our studio running and engineering the show. You can find information about the stories we mentioned today at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.